Hey, my name's Johnny, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm
glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be sober. I'm glad to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank the committee or whoever's responsible for allowing me the extreme privilege of participating in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. See, it's always been my belief, and I hope it always remains that way until they pat me in the face with a scoop, that it's a privilege for me to be allowed to come and sit with you good people. I have never been able to get it through my head, and I hope I never do, that I have some right to be here just because I don't drink alcohol. I hope I never get that far out to think that I have a lot of rights just because I don't drink alcohol to come in here and occupy space and take up time and effort of somebody who's really trying to do something about their life. It's a privilege for me. And I believe that as long as I think it's a privilege to be allowed to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, then I always have the opportunity to earn my seat when I sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think I have a right to be there just because there's a seat there. Now, I don't know how many people here are new tonight, and really not important. But I hope the word being sober doesn't offend you as bad as it offended me when I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on the fourth day of November, 1959, and the people of Alcoholics Anonymous talked to me about being sober. And my first reaction to that was that Alcoholics Anonymous had nothing to offer me. Because I was as physically sober when I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as I am right now. Physically sober. Matter of fact, I don't know when it was I had my last drink. I spent the last 9 months before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous crawling around in a cell in solitary confinement in a maximum security penitentiary, drifting in and out of total insanity. And you newcomers, that's what you got to shoot for when you come in here. I always get a kick out of that. I mean, the newcomers sitting there going, where's the bankers? We trod fallen women, wore out teachers. Could you imagine? Does it scare you if you got kids in school? If you heard Liz last night? God, I'm glad mine are out. I'll tell you that. But you know, I haven't had a drink of alcohol or a mood-altering chemical in my system from the first day I sat with you to this moment. And I have learned there's a tremendous difference between being sober and living in sobriety. I believe that being sober is just the absence of any type of alcohol or chemical in my system. That's all that is. That's being physically sober, which I was when I came to you. But because of your examples and a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have learned to live in a thing that's called sobriety. And if I couldn't do that, I'd probably be drunk before I got home. And sobriety to me isn't anything wonderful or not. It's the ability to live peacefully and comfortably and joyously with me and you and God. That's all that is. And if I couldn't do that, I'd probably be drunk before I got home tomorrow. So you got to learn to do that here. And I didn't know that when I sat in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't know anything. I'd like to be able to stand here tonight and go along with a popular theory in the world and tell you without a shadow of a doubt, be able to jump into victimization real quick and tell you that's where alcohol and drugs took me to. God, I'd love to be able to tell you that. That's where I took me to. The only thing that alcohol and drugs ever did for me, it kept me alive long enough to find Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm as sure as I'm standing here, if I hadn't taken a drink of alcohol, I'd have blown my brains out before I was 9 years old. I've always been an emotional misfit. I never seemed to fit anywhere. Always like an oddball, like the third thumb on the right hand or something. I was just always odd and weird, angry, hostile, and bitter. I didn't like anything or anybody. Didn't know what was going on. And see, I really don't know whether I was born an alcoholic or not. That's totally debatable or undebatable to me. But I do know I was born needing an answer. Now, my problem was I didn't know what the problem was. Now, it's kind of hard to find an answer for a problem if you don't know what the problem is. And if you're as goofy as I am, you wander around trying to get fixed everywhere but where you're supposed to get fixed. Like a lost little fool running around out there. See, whiskey has never been a mystery to me because everybody in my family drank whiskey. They made it, and they drank it, and they did what people who made and drank whiskey did. I mean, they used to gather up on Saturdays. They'd beat each other up, steal each other's whiskey, steal each other's women. Oh, they had a hell of a time there. Then I guess whoever survived was the king for the week. I don't know how they worked the deal out. But you see, I understood that. As strange as that sounds, as far I could understand the violence. I could understand the all that stuff that went on, the excitement of it. You know, it's like putting your foot in somebody's belly. You know, it's a spiritual experience. You know, I could understand that. Yeah. What confused me was these same people who did that to one another on Saturdays, put their arms around one another on Wednesdays and said, "We love one another because we're family." Now, I don't know whether it's true or not, but I might have said to myself, if that's what love is, you can keep it. Because I don't ever remember uttering that word to another human being prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous or for a long time after I was here. It was not in my vocabulary. I just didn't do it. But I knew I needed an answer, so I started looking for a way out of this dilemma real early. And I looked around one day, and my eyes fell upon my grandmother. Now, my grandmother was a kindly old lady who lived till she was 90 years old and never took a drink of alcohol. She never smoked a cigarette. She just wandered through life like that. Grandma wouldn't think it's a big deal. I've been sober 34 years. She said, "I haven't had none for 90. My answer to that was, there's three or four times when you should have taken a drink. But I used to watch my grandmother. I was amazed by her, because she would get up on Sunday morning and she'd put on the best she had and she'd take off and go somewhere for 2 or 3 hours. Now, while my grandmother was gone, wherever it was she was gone to, there was a magic transformation that came over my grandmother. Now, my grandmother would come back, she would be a little lighter in her step, a little easier in her being, and she'd be dancing over the body and cooking and cleaning these crazy people up and singing songs to Jesus. I took a look at that. Then my grandfather, he used to take off on Tuesdays or Wednesdays. He'd come back the following week sometime. And he came back in all various shapes and forms. One time they brought him back on a wagon. He'd been shot and stabbed and thrown off the second floor balcony of a whorehouse in Kansas City. Now, I took a look at that and put my keen alcoholic mind to work. This is the only place you're ever going to hear about the keen alcoholic mind. You never hear one of them Al-Anons talking about the keen alcoholic mind. They may get up and say the keen alcoholic got up last night and peed in the linen closet, but they... I want you to know something. If I was that much smarter before I got here, I'd be dead now. So I did what I was supposed to do, looking for an answer. I figured some crazy thing, like a lot of people, that all I got to do is go where Grandma goes, do what Grandma does, and be like Grandma. But I'm not like my grandmother. My grandmother is not alcoholic, but I didn't know that. And so I got up, put on the best I had, went with my grandmother, and sit down in my grandmother's church with my grandmother, and watched this thing come over my grandmother. I watched it. I looked at my grandma, and there's a guy sitting next to her, and the same thing's happening to him. But there ain't nothing happening to me. All I'm doing is feeling more guilty than I was when I went in there, because I'm not thinking the way they say I'm supposed to be thinking. You see, they're telling me I'm supposed to love and honor and respect my parents, and I hate them. They're telling me I'm supposed to love my brothers, and I hate them too. And I'm frightened to death they're going to find that out. And I don't know what's going on. And I'm about as close to going insane as I'll possibly ever get. And I didn't know there was an answer going to be around the corner a couple weeks later. In the most unlikely place that you'd ever think about. Because some I said I'd never do. I watched my grandfather stash his jug one Saturday or Sunday. And when he left, I went over and picked up his jug and took a drink of alcohol. That's all I did. I did something I said I'd never do. I took a drink of alcohol. The next couple of minutes is what makes me alcoholic. I'm not alcoholic because I spent the next 20 years of my life creating mayhem out there in the world. I'm an alcoholic because I have some type of abnormal reaction to alcohol. Now, it's not a bad reaction, really. It's a good reaction. I mean, if it was a bad reaction, who the hell ever drink it again?
My name is Clancy Emerson. I would have been better, but I was scarred by the Norwegian Lutheran Church in Oak Harbor. I thought you were gone. We got anything more surprising over there for me? But I remember that very specifically. I remembered every Sunday morning of my life. I remember sitting in that church with my grandmother. I remember going there and sitting because I wanted so desperately, even then as a small child, to feel the way my grandmother looked when she came back from that place, that magic place that she went to. And I remember sitting in that church that day and watching this thing come, this transformation come over my grandmother. And the guy sat next to her, but there was nothing happening to me. And I don't know whether it was a feeling of dejection or whatever it was. I just felt awful about that. You know, I didn't know what was going on. I was absolutely and totally confused. You know, it took me many, many, many years, sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, to come to the realization there was nothing at all wrong with my grandmother's church. Nothing at all. There was something wrong with me sitting in it. And so what I did for the next 20-some-odd years of my life, I searched everywhere in the world out there looking for the answer that would make me feel good in here. Always looking for this answer, for this escape from this thing that had me in the scripts that I didn't understand, this terrible malady that I had called alcoholism, and I didn't know it was that. A couple of weeks later, I'm sitting on the back porch of my grandpa's house, and my grandpa drinking whiskey out of a fruit jar. And he put the jar down, and he went somewhere, and I took a drink of it. That's all I did. I just took a drink. And the next couple of minutes of my life was what makes me an alcoholic. See, I'm not an alcoholic because I spent the next 20 years of my life creating mayhem out there in the world. I'm an alcoholic because I have some type of a allergy to alcohol, the book says. I have this physical reaction from alcohol that most of the people who drink it don't have. It's not really a bad reaction, it's a very good reaction, because alcohol has the uncanny ability to go down inside of me and still the screaming madness, it's all. It takes me from the black pit of nothingness and stands me into the gray fringes of the business of living. It installs in me some type of arrogance. It says, damn you world, it's all right. I'm not good enough to be around the good people, but I'm too good to be around the bad people. It's okay right here. That's what alcohol did for me. It's a magnificent thing for people like me. But that's not the thing that drove me into the gates of insanity and death and beyond. Not the physical reaction I got from alcohol. It was the thing that kicked in right behind it that our book says is limited to alcoholics of my type. It's a thing that's called a phenomenon of craving. Once I take a drink of alcohol, once I take a drink, I'm drinking to overcome a craving that's beyond all human understanding and beyond all human help. I didn't know that either. That's the thing that enslaved me. That phenomena that took off. And so what happened to me for the next 20 years of my life, every time I drank alcohol, the same thing happened. I took a drink of alcohol. And 3 days later, I was pulled out from underneath a bridge, stood in front of a judge, and sentenced to the Hutchinson State Reform School. 20 years later, I took a drink of alcohol. They pulled me out of Corner Compton, stood me in front of a judge, and sentenced me to 20 years in the penitentiary. That's what happened to me when I drank. I got drunk and went places. I just travel around out there, man. I went from reform school to junior penitentiaries to nut houses. Now they call them treatment centers. I like nut house better. It's a little more macho. I figure if you're going to be bad, you ought to be bad. I really do. I don't think you ought to quit drinking because you puke a little. I think you ought to hang in there. I think you ought to give it everything you got. I did. I threw everything into the battle and lost the fight. I didn't even know I was in a fight, and I didn't know what I was fighting, but I gave it everything I had. I gave it my sanity, my health, every dime and dollar I got in. I threw every piece of my family into it. I gave it everything. I run them all off. I just gave it everything I had. And at the age of 27 or 28 years old, I arrived and stepped to Los Angeles County Jail dead on arrival, practically. Everything. Everything gone. Everything was gone in between that time. Pursuing this answer to this terrible thing that was going on inside of me, this, God, what's the matter with me? Why can't I find this thing? What's going on? And temporary things like alcohol seemed to be a tremendous relief to me. I was sitting on a furlough from a reform school, and I'm 10 or 11 years old. I'm drinking a bottle of Marco Petri red wine, which was my drink. Most of you have never heard of Marco Petri red wine. And the reason for that is because of the experimental stage of the Thunderbird. That's why you never heard of it. I'll tell you how bad it was. It never saw a grape. But it gets you. And I'm drinking this stuff, and it's not something I hear in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. And I'm not saying it's right, wrong, or different. It's just not my experience. I hear people say all the time, alcohol just quit working in my life. Alcohol never quit working in my life. If alcohol had quit working in my life, why in the world would I need to come to Alcoholics Anonymous? If alcohol didn't work, if it didn't do that. But you see, in the back of my sick little mind, I know what makes the big hurt go away. It always has. You know, and I can fool myself into believing that this time it's going to be different. And alcoholics like me do not drink to get drunk. I'm sorry. Drug addicts get loaded to get loaded, but alcoholics like me do not drink to get drunk on the first drink. We just drink to go. And all the heads going. That's what alcoholics drink for. And then once they've triggered this phenomena in cases of alcoholics of my type, I've got to drink it to the bitter end. The bitter end. And I don't know that. I don't know what's going on. I'm drinking this stuff. It ain't taking me where I want it to take me. And I'm in this circumstances, in this neighborhood gang of mine, and I'm sitting there. The guy said, try these, Johnny. And he gave me some pills. I remember saying to him, what are those? Will they bother me if I take them? I took them. Jesus. You put anything in my right hand, it'll go to my mouth. I don't care what it is. Tell you something, thank God they weren't X-Lax. Do you realize we could have a whole new 12-step program called Laxatives Anonymous? I could be standing here this morning as the adult child of a laxative taker. I would have been functional, but Mother sat on the toilet all the time. Well, I hear stuff stupider than that in some of these things that masquerade as AME. I really do. You ought to hear it. I mean, that's really something. Work. Thank God it worked. Because I'll tell you, if it hadn't worked, you'd have another talker here this morning. A couple years later, I'm on a furlough from another reform school. I'm sitting around my little gang again. And I'm sitting there, and I'm drinking this wine, and I'm eating these pellets, and doing whatever else we're doing. And it ain't quite filling the bill that day, I guess. And a guy stuck a needle in my arm. And for the next 14 years of my life, I stuck needles in my arm, and I ran in and out of institutions. That's what I do. See, I live out there in the streets, and I do what people like me who live in the streets do. I destroy everything that comes in contact with me. There's a reason for that, I'm sure. You see, I'm a taker. I'm a taker of things, and I'm a user of people, so therefore I'm a loser. I'm selfish, and I'm self-centered, and I'm self-serving, and I got an ego bigger than this whole room. My entire lifetime was spent before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and for a long time after I was here. And probably even a great deal of the time today. I'm not really aware of it all the time. Without a conscious concern or a conscious thought for any other human being who lived upon the face of this earth, I wasn't interested in you at all. Unless you had something I wanted, and then when I got it, I cast aside like so much trash and I went on about my business. That's the way I lived my life. I didn't live my life like that one day or one week or when the heat got on or when it got too bad. I lived my life like that from my earliest recollection of life until a long time after I was an alcoholic. No wonder I was in bondage. No wonder. Looking for an answer all the time and never seeing able to put my finger on it quite right. I, knew a lot of things that substituted for answers at the particular time in my life that came through there, money, property, and prestige, wine, women, and song, and the whole ball game. But I always knew, way down deep in my soul, wherever I went, that that wasn't quite the answer. And what happened to me is that I ended up at the ripe old age of 28 years old, crawling around in a cell in solitary confinement in a maximum security penitentiary, drifting in and out of total insanity. You know what's significant about that to me today is I've had the weekend spent with my sponsor, and I've seen a lot of people that I love and care for and who care for me. And that day when I came to in that cell, drifting around in them long-handled underwear, there wasn't a single solitary soul left upon the face of this earth that would send me a penny postcard. They were all gone. But I think they should be gone, and I don't think I have any right to have any of them back just because I got sober. I think everything that's been good and decent in my life since I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous is some type of an unwarranted gift from a God that I've discovered sitting with you. They're not my rights, and they're not my inherited rights. They're just some type of an unwarranted gift, and I treat them very kindly and very gently, and I love them very much. But I don't know what's going on there. I came out of that thing and was, I'll tell you what happened. I came out of solitary that day, and I went in front of the associate warden in charge of custody in San Quentin. And he looked at me, and it was when the gangs were getting started in the penitentiary, and I was right smack dab in the middle of all of it. And he said, "Johnny, I don't know what I'm going to do with you. You're without a doubt the most corrupt individual I've ever seen in my life." He said, "You seem to have no morals, no standards, no nothing. Nothing is too beneath you or too good for you." And I gave him my smug little answer because I was slick and keen and cool and tough and had a reputation. I said, "Well, if that's the way you feel about it, why don't you put me back in solitary where I can get some rest?" And he looked at me and he said, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do, smart guy." He said, "There's two buses leaving this institution this week, and whichever one gets there first, you're going to be on it." One bus was going to the adjustment center in Folsom, which I'd been to before. And the other was going down to a place in Tehachapi where they had just started up a new program called Profound Group Counseling, something like that. I guess they were going to rehabilitate me. And what happened was the bus that was going to Folsom was supposed to be there first and had a flat tire. So the bus from Tehachapi got there and I got on it. And we went down south and we stopped at a place in San Luis Obispo, and I remember this very specifically. And I'm 27 or 28 years old. You got to remember this. And I'm sitting on this bus this morning, and this guy came across the bus. He had, I never will forget him, he had silver gray hair, he had a black sweater on, a pair of khaki denims, and a pair of carpet slippers, and he poured us a cup of coffee. And I looked at him, and the only thought I had in my head was, "I wonder how long it's going to be before the state of California or the federal government puts me out the pasture for the rest of my life." Not much of a future looking at anybody, but that was my deal. There was no hope left there that someday it's going to make it anymore. And I'd been everywhere and done everything. And I went on down to this institution, and one day on a Sunday, I'm sitting in the yard. It's in November 1959. I'm sitting on this yard, and I looked up, and I saw some women walk across the yard. And I got up and I followed them. And they wandered into an old Quonset hut of a building. And I wandered into that old Quonset hut of a building too, and I sit down in there. I didn't know then that that was going to be the day that changed my life, that I had reached the crest of my insanity, and from there on out I was going to level out and start in a different way. I didn't know that. Not any more than I knew that day I sat on my grandpa's back porch and drank that whiskey that I know my life was going to take on a direction that I would never return to again until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just don't know those things. I'm not aware of those things. I don't think that we're supposed to be aware of those things. And I moved in and I sit out in that room. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for no good reason. I came here to smell perfume. And I've been honking and sniffing around here ever since. And, I tell you, there's a lot of nice cologne in here, I'll tell you that. So it doesn't really, how can I take any credit for coming to Alcoholics Anonymous? I can't take any credit for anything that's happened to me since I've been here that's good and decent, because I can't take any credit for coming here. If I'd have known where I was coming, I wouldn't have come. I was an alcoholic. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I had never been called an alcoholic. I had never been called... I've been called a lot of things. I've been called a drug dealer. I've been called a white slaver. I've been called a killer. I've been called a lot of things. But I had never been called an alcoholic. I mean, come on. I didn't know what it was, and nobody else. It wasn't bandied around like a second-rate novel then. And I didn't know what these people were. I sat down in this meeting that day, and I looked up on the backboard, and I saw two big A's, and I thought I was in some type of an anti-aircraft brigade. I didn't know. I said to the guy, what's this? And he said, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I sunk down in my seat trying to hide out in there. I didn't want anybody to see the big gangster hang around him winos. I got a reputation I'm establishing here. You come on now. You know what I mean? I'm bad. I think. I'm a frightened little puke, but I'm bad. I'm bad. I'm bad. I tell you, I'm so frightened that I attack people before they find it out. And I didn't need to drink to do that, Leo. I did that when I was cold sober, because I'm frightened to death when I'm cold sober. And I didn't know. And I sit there, waited. I don't know what's going on. And I waited for these women to get up and tell their racy stories, I guess. And you got to remember that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there weren't very many young, pretty girls around here. If they were, they weren't sending up that penitentiary where I was at, I'll tell you that. These old gals got up to talk that day, and one of them said she'd drank for a long time. Hell, you could look at her and know she'd been somewhere for a long time. She said, I used to drink. I said, I'll bet you did. Bad stuff, too. I knew everything when I got here. I'm a walking encyclopedia of useless information. I know so damn much about what ain't true, I don't know what is true. And I'll tell you, this is something that I think about practically every day of my life. I sat in that room that day, and unbeknownst to me at that moment, and I don't think any newcomer ever knows it, I am sitting there staring at the answer that I had sold my soul for. But I didn't recognize the answer because I didn't know what the problem was. I didn't have a clue. But I was smack dab in the middle of it. But my salvation is this. It was then and it is now. I was kind of attracted to these people who come up there for some particular reason. That, you know, the women didn't have anything to do with it because they weren't pretty and nothing. It just, there was something about these people that I didn't understand. I know it was something that kind of drew me to them. I didn't know understand what it was. I know what it is today. I didn't know then. You know, it's the same thing that comes brings me to. I'm attracted to alcoholics. We are attracted to one another. It's this seemingly bond we have that nobody can tell. You can almost, I mean, I don't know how many of you have ever watched a television program and said you're kind of attracted to that guy, and sooner or later you find out that maybe he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, for Christ's sake. You know, it's an unwritten thing. It's the most, see, I didn't know what they did. You know what these people did? They got up on Sunday morning and drove 185 miles up those old back roads and spent 2 hours talking to a room full of people who didn't want to listen to them. People like me who sat in the back row and made fun of them. Now, I'll tell you how sick that is. Here I am, I'm sitting in the penitentiary, don't know when I'm going home. And I'm making fun of people who are leaving in an hour. But I'm hip, if you'd ask me. But I don't know what goes on. I'm mystified by these people. There's another reason for that, too. You see, for the first time in my life, I'm looking at givers. I'm looking at people who are giving a little just for the hell of giving it. And I don't understand that because I'm a taker. Takers don't understand givers. Takers understand takers, and takers hang out with takers. But they don't understand givers. And I'm puzzled by all this. I don't know why anybody would do this. Nobody that I ever knew would do anything like this. I don't understand it, so I'd ask them simple questions like, hey, what do you get out of coming up here anyhow? You like to look at the animals in the cages? What's your deal anyhow? And they'd say things like, well, kid, when you can answer that question, you won't have to ask it. You know, you'd go back and try to ponder how much on the psychiatrist's couch you heard that. Or something. But you know what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous? It's not an opinion. It's a fact based on my experience of sitting with you on an average of 4 or 5 or 6 times a week for all these years. You know what I've learned? My old sponsor, D. Dead sponsor Norm Alpa used to talk a great deal about crossing over an invisible line from controlled to uncontrolled drinking. I don't have any qualms with that whatsoever. But I've come to learn that there's an invisible line in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just as sure as I'm standing here, there's an invisible line here. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, and you don't cross over it, you're going to die drunk. And I don't care what anybody tells you. It's true because I've sat around and watched it with my eyes open for many, many years. And that invisible line is where you have to cross over from being a taker to being a giver. And if you don't cross it and you're an alcoholic of my type, you're probably going to die drunk or go permanently insane. There ain't no way to beat the deal if you're an alcoholic. And it's backed up by this book. This book says that my problems seem to be selfishness and self-centeredness, and I must be rid of it or it kills me. Now, I don't know all that. I don't know all that sitting in my early meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm probably more confused here than I've ever been in my life. And every time one of you got up here to talk, it proved to me without a shadow of a doubt that I was an alcoholic. It kept cementing the idea, how could I be alcoholic? These people got up and said, I used to drink, now I don't drink anymore, and everything is wonderful. And I'm sitting in this meeting as physically sober as these people who are talking, and I'm crazy. I said, how can I be alcoholic? I'm not drinking either, and I'm nuts, for Christ's sake. And they say, get busy. I equated being busy with being in motion. I thought the faster you move, the smaller target you make. And that's the way it is in my neighborhood. It's always that way down there. Now it's even worse. They got automatic weapons down there. They're really after them. And I move quicker. I can tell you how you can move fast in Alcoholics Anonymous, and nobody can even recognize you as a member. You move quick. Pick up all coffee cups. Ashtrays. Move back there and sit in inventory point and act like you ain't done nothing. I used to do that. And I say, see, how could I be alcoholic? How in the world could I be alcoholic? These people say they're alcoholic, and they're the only people I've ever seen who said they were alcoholic. And they don't drink, and they're busy, and their life is just wonderful. And I'm doing all these things, and I don't know what's wrong with me. And I'm getting ready. You know, I know how you are and how they are in Washington, D.C., but when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous as a newcomer, I had very selective hearing. All I ever wanted to hear was things that were going to help me. Hell with you. What can I get out of this deal? If it got interesting, just didn't listen to it. I don't think I'm any different than any other newcomer. I think that's why most newcomers come here. Come here to get something. And I came here to get something. And what I got was the information I wanted to get. I said in meetings, I hear people say, good things start to happen to you when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. People start to recognize the changes in you when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm getting ready to go to the parole board. And I want somebody to recognize them changes, particularly the parole board. I want all this stuff to happen to me. About 2 weeks before I got ready to go to the parole board, I'm armed with all this information. I remind you, I've only been going to meetings, I don't know, 6 or 7 months, once a week, with my attitude. Nothing's changed. I got a file folder in there about that high full of the atrocities I've committed in the world and my attitude. And I expect everybody to recognize that I have changed majestically in these few months. And 2 weeks before I got ready to go to the parole board, I got a letter from this woman that I was married to, who was the mother of my children, particularly my oldest daughter, who I'd only seen once, born while I was in San Quentin. And she said that she was taking my infant daughter back to the Midwest, and she divorced me, and she ran off with a cowboy singer. Not a cowboy singer. I mean, anything but a cowboy singer. You can have the kid, the money, everything, but not a cowboy singer. I mean, come on, I got a reputation. I'm trying. You can't go out in the yard and say, my little lady ran off with a cowboy singer. Now I'm a dude. You know, oh, God, Johnny. Commit suicide. That's too bad. I mean, she could have ran off with the biggest drug dealer from Colombia or something. You know what I mean? Or died of an overdose. But a cowboy singer. That hurt me terribly. And then I went in front of a parole board and they told me I couldn't go home. And I don't think in my lifetime I've ever hated a group of people any more than I hated that people of Alcoholics Anonymous at that moment. Because what you got me to do, and I didn't even realize it at the time, you got me to rescind a vow that I'd made when I was 12 or 13 years old, that I'd never show anybody any human emotion again as long as I lived, that I'd never trust anybody ever again. And somewhere in that period of time that I was coming, sitting in your meetings, no matter how far out of it I was, and no matter how closed-minded I was, or how different I thought I was, somewhere or other that seeped in there, and I got a little ray of hope somewhere. And I went back to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that Sunday morning to denounce you in front of my fellow convicts. But I never got to the podium that day. I sat in the front row of that meeting with that old lady, and an old lady by the name of Myrtle Snyder, and I held her hand, and she told me over and over and over again, "Honey, there has to be a reason for everything that happens to you in this lifetime." Now, what she told me wasn't really important at that moment. The way I felt was. I sat in that meeting that day, and I held that old lady's hand, and for the first time in my entire life, I had a feeling about me that everything was going to be all right. Now, I was also smart enough to know that it wasn't mine. I was also smart enough to know that it was just these people, that it was only going to be mine temporarily till they left. And so I hung onto her hand until she got to the gate of the institution, and I said to her, "What was this thing? What was it that I tried to get?" And she looked at me, and she smiled, and she had the prettiest sparkling blue eyes you've ever seen, and etched in a Wynette's face, just absolutely chiseled in granite, but it was gorgeous. And she said, "Sweetheart, the answer to any question you may ever have in your lifetime lies between the covers of the book called Alcoholics Anonymous." Somewhere in a period of time, I can't pinpoint it, I went into this book of ours, Alcoholics Anonymous, to try to find this thing that I had felt when I held her hand. And one day, sitting in a room with a man doing what our program of recovery says is the fifth step, the greatest single event that ever happened to me in my life happened to me, that thing came back to me. It came back to me after I said to that man that I was an alcoholic. From way down deep inside of me, that came out. And from that day to this day, I have never had any doubt in my mind about what I am, what I'm supposed to do, and who I'm supposed to do it with. And everything in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that there is to do around here, I've just wanted to do it. You see, as I stand here before you this morning, something that I've known for over 30 years, I know exactly what's wrong with me. Exactly. I'm an alcoholic, and I suffer from a disease called alcoholism. I am not an alcoholic and anything. When I was an alcoholic and something or other, I couldn't have your program. And the reason I couldn't have it is I separated me from you. I wasn't like you. I'm better than you. I'm worse than you. I'm smarter than you. I'm slicker than you. I'm hipper than you, but I'm not like you. When I became just like you, an alcoholic, and admitted to my innermost self that I had this terrible malady, it became necessary for me to fulfill the conditions of this program of recovery that's the only help for people like me in these 7,000 years of recorded history. This is the only thing that's ever worked on a permanent basis. These are things that I must do if I want to live and have my being. I just have to. And so for the next period of time that I was in that institution, to the best of my ability, I completed the first 9 steps of our program of recovery to the best of my ability at that time. And when I walked out of the penitentiary on the 4th day of June, 1961, all I wanted to do was come and sit in meetings. It's all. It was a dream I had. I never thought it would ever come true because I didn't know I was ever going to get out of the penitentiary. I said to myself way back there somewhere once I found out what was wrong with me, that if these good people would give me the privilege of coming and sitting in their meetings, I'd do anything they asked me to do. And so I came out of the penitentiary that day with this little dream. And I went home to see my mother, and she fell off the steps blind drunk. I picked her up, and I put her on a couch, and I said, "Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting." She said, "Fine, I think you should." I'd like to stand here and tell you that my mother got sober and come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a wonderful thing, but it's not my experience. My mother died drunk. I watched the tragedy of Alcoholics Anonymous to an alcoholic and my mother for over 30 years. Play this sad song. I watched my mother get sober because she could no longer drink. And I'd watch her come to Alcoholics Anonymous and sit here until she could no longer sit here. And I watched her go back out there and drink until she could no longer drink out there, and she'd come back in there. She was a little sought-off Irish woman, but she could drink whiskey out of a bottle. My mother always carried a half a pint wherever she went. I love my mother. I'd have given anything in my soul, practically my own life, if my mother could have found this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous and deep inside of her. But it's not my experience. I sat at my mother's bedside about 3 years ago and watched my mother die. We went through a terrible month. My sponsor and I went through it on the telephone two or three times. And I didn't know what to do. I just sit there with her, watched her die. I was the last thing my mother ever saw in the face of this earth. You know, I hear a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous about the denial of this disease. The book Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't talk about a denial. My mother wasn't in denial that she had this disease. My mother lived under delusion that her life was the only normal one that she lived by. If you'd have walked up to my mother and said to my mother's bed 5 minutes before my mother died and said to my mother, "Aren't you proud of your son, Johnny? Man, he came out of that cesspool that he lived in, and he stands out there on the sunny side of the street, and he works, and he supports his family, and he does what he's supposed to do. Aren't you proud of him?" You know what my mother would have told you? My mother would have told you, "My son's not an alcoholic. My son's got a life that's got a lot better when he quit running around with them Mexicans." Such is the great delusion of this madness that we have. My mother lived under it. I saw it firsthand. That's not a denial. That's a delusion. It's an amazing thing. I learned the greatest lesson of my life watching my mother and my youngest daughter drift in and out of this thing called life. I don't have the power to get anybody sober. I don't have the power to get them drunk either. I don't even have any power to keep me sober, for Christ's sake. Where would I get any power? This book says that I have a daily reprieve contingent upon my maintenance of certain spiritual conditions. And I explained to you yesterday what my spiritual condition is. Showing up and suiting up and showing up and doing what I'm asked to do around here. That's all. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to get good, because I'm not a good person. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I got a ray of hope that maybe I could live and have my being, and like my papa said, maybe live somewhere in the world and try to wipe out part of the record before I leave here. I'll never be able to wipe it all out, because I created too much before I got here. But I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. A guy walked up to me one night and said, "Johnny, I'm going to be your sponsor." A little skinny guy, talked fast. His name was Norm Alton. I said, "What's a sponsor?" He said, "I'm going to help you get things done." I looked at him and I said, "I don't need any help for nothing. Do you understand who you're talking to?" He says, "Yes." "And I'm going to help you anyhow." And I said, "Well, what do you want me to do?" He says, "Why do you ask me?" I said, "For Christ's sake, you just told me you're going to be my sponsor." He says, "If I can't run my life, what makes you think I can run yours?" I said, "Then what am I supposed to do, Norm?" He says, "You do what I do." I said, "Just what is it you do, Norm?" He says, "If you do what I do, then you'll know what I do." You know, the people like me who are a little brain damaged, who spend a lot of time in them therapist couches and in straitjackets and stuff, you have to kind of give them these little bits and pieces. I mean, you can't hit within this. You have to kind of give them these little bits and pieces. I mean, you can't hit within this intellectual knowledge. I mean, because. The great myth of sponsorship is that they tell you what to do all the time. No, they don't. What the sponsor does is throws down the gauntlet. That's what Norm did. He put it down. He said, "Here's the gauntlet. Here, you want to know what I do? Hot shot? Come and find out." Oh. Now, I couldn't just do that at meetings once a week or once a month or whenever I felt obligated to go see him. I had to go find out what he did. Not here. And they ate me, because I knew what he did here. Find out what he does out there. I handled the little people. You know, the waitresses and the retail clerks and the people on the golf course and his family, friends. The only way you're going to find that out is to be there. I mean, that's deep, isn't it? I mean, you can't get this hearsay. You can't hearsay is not even admissible in a court of law, according to the lawyers. But I had to go find out. I did find out. I found out what he did. And in so doing, I started trying to act that way. That's all. I just started trying to act that way. I didn't know how to act. I don't know what to do. Well, I knew all about this program of recovery because I studied this book for 19 months, for Christ's sake. But I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous and its people, or how to act here, or behave here, or what to do here. And somebody has to show me. That's what sponsors are all about. Show you how you're supposed to behave here, what you're supposed to do, how you're supposed to act, how you're supposed to dress, how much respect you're supposed to have for Alcoholics Anonymous. What goes on here? Why not? I don't know what goes on in Alcoholics. I never been. I don't like people. So I got to find out. I got to go sit in meetings. You yell at me, tell me to shut up when I wanted to visit the meeting. I just wanted to visit. Let me sit still. I just, you know, wanted to walk out of the aisle and shuffle on back to the coffee thing and look around and pick out my next victim. He made me sit still. One night we were in a meeting and Chuck was talking. Sometimes Chuck talked a long time. And I was a little younger then, so my kidneys were a little more healthy. And I had to go to the bathroom. And I said to him, I reached over, I said, Norm. He said, shut up. And I said, but I have to go to the bathroom. He said, sit still. And I said, I may wet my pants. He said, so what? He said, cool. You know what the first thing, you know what the first piece of instruction you ever gave me was? Go to work. What? Work? He said I was a bum. I told him I wasn't a bum. I told him I was a member of AA. And he told me I was a bum because bums don't work. Go to work. I went to work. Somebody stole my first paycheck. You want to hear somebody scream? Listen to a thief when they get stolen from. I tell you, I ran and raved and hollered and jumped, and if I could have found that guy, you'd have another talker here this morning. I'd be up there in the adjustment center in Folsom if I was still alive. Talking about Alcoholics Anonymous really doesn't work. But I just found right. He was a funny guy. I called him up. You know, I'd call him up in the middle of the night to see if he'd answer the phone. I didn't care what he said. I didn't have any problem. I just see if he'd answer the phone. See, if you don't trust people, and you who are new here and you don't have sponsors, you think about getting. If you don't think your sponsor means what he says, test him. Call him up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Listen to the dial tone to answer it. Mm-hmm. I'd say to a Norm, he'd say, what do you want, jackass? Some of us have to work tomorrow. I'd say, Norm, my program isn't working. He'd say, try ours. It's not my program, it's our program. Singularly, I don't have any program. Singularly, I'm a lost ship out there struggling around looking for destruction. I can handle it with you. I can handle it being around you people, and I can handle it with a strong sponsor who gives me directions. My sponsor set a great tone for me, so it was just, you know, just a natural thing for me to go in with Clancy because they're two of a kind, these two guys were. They loved Alcoholics Anonymous, and they loved the people in it, and they didn't tell him anything that would harm me. He didn't tell me anything that would harm me. He only told me things that would benefit me and make me good and make me useful to you. That's all. I was with him one night. He was talking at a meeting, and I went back at the coffee break. We have a coffee break out on the coast. I went back out there and stood by the literature table. And a guy walked up and tapped me on the shoulder and said, Johnny. And I said, yes. He said, I heard you talk the other night. And I said, you did? You know, I mean, you? He says, yeah. I said, do you know you're a miracle? I said, really? You know how humble we are. You just, what was it I said? By the time he got through with me, I was gone. You know, I mean, Jesus, I'm looking for my spaceship somewhere, for Christ's sake. I'm out of it, man. I kind of float back to my seat and sit there dazed, looking out the window for my star or something. I don't know. And, my comet, nowadays. And on the way home that night, Norm's driving. He looked at me, and He said, are you smoking that stuff, jackass? And I said, you don't understand this, Norm, but I'm a miracle. He didn't understand. He slammed on the brakes, Then I run into the divider and stopped the car, reached over and screamed at me, "You're what?" And I said, "I'm a miracle." He said, "Where do you get this stuff?" And I said, "In a meeting." "Can't argue with that, can you?" "Jackass, you're not a miracle." He said, "Alcoholics Anonymous is the miracle. You're just a small part of it." Now, I don't know what that does for the miracles in the audience. But I can tell you what it's done for me. And this is really important. It's kept me small enough to stay here. It's on. Can you possibly understand what a guy like me would do, an egotist like me would do, if I thought I was a miracle? You've got to let your imagination soar. I'd probably be hiring Greyhound buses to take us all to Waco to do it right this time. Maybe I'd be starting up another Heaven's Gate or something. I don't know. I have that type of an ego. I understand that type of an ego. And I have that. My sponsor made sure he just kept squeezing it and coming. That is a great tool that a sponsor seems to have in my life. Because left to my own selfishness and my own centeredness and kept running my own life, I would absolutely and totally destroy me. It's an amazing thing. I run around with this old man by the name of Chuck, Clancy's sponsor, who was my father in Alcoholics Anonymous. I adored that man. I loved him probably more than I've ever loved anything before or since in my lifetime. I loved that old man. And I used to ride around with him, and I was absolutely tongue-tied around him, just in awe of him all the time. And I'd just say things to him, and he cracked me all the time, because I could never get him right. One night I was at a meeting with him, and I picked something off the literature table, and we were up in Santa Maria, and we're going to come home, and I'm going to read this thing to him. I said, "Look at this, Papa, I want to read this to you." And he said, "What is it, son?" I said, "Why We Were Chosen." He said, "We weren't chosen, Johnny." He said, "What makes you think we were chosen?" I said, "It says right here." He said, "Johnny, we're not chosen." He said, "We're all God's kids." And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "If I am, you are, and if you are, I am." And he said, "It makes the rain to fall on the just as well as the unjust." I was reminded about last night when we were going to dinner. I was watching rain fall on the other cars as well as ours. If we were chosen, we had clear sailing. And I said, "I don't understand this. If I'm not chosen, I'm not special, how come I'm sober, Papa? And why am I sober? I know people who are far better people than I'll ever be who aren't sober, who can't get sober, who have died drunk. Why?" And he smiled at me. He had that way of putting his hand on my shoulder that just kind of melted me. And he said, "Son, you've come to understand you're one of God's kids and you act like it." And I said, "What do God's kids act like, Papa?" And he said, "Well, they just wander around in the world and they try to help God's kids get things done they need to have done, and they do it for free and they do it for fun." Now, I don't know about any of you, because I don't know of any classroom or any place that gives you startling examples of God's kids. In my brief tenure in Alcoholics Anonymous, these few short years that I've been here, I've had the extreme privilege of being around the three men who's had the greatest influence of my life in my entire lifetime. My sponsor, Norm Alpie, I'm as sure as I'm standing here, was one of God's kids. I know that. Nobody has to tell me that. I know that. And I know that because I watched him. I watched him night after night after night, after weekend after weekend after weekend, leave his family and his kids and his home and go out amongst the world and try to help God's kids get things done that need to be done. I watched him. I watched him with my own eyes. Now, if he's not one of God's kids, I don't want to be one. Sorry. I watched that old man that I loved so much, that I had the great privilege of nurturing in his last year of life, which I'll treasure with me till I die, do the same thing. I never knew anybody in my life, with maybe the exception of Clancy, who does more for Alcoholics Anonymous than that old man did. Night after night, he got in that car till he was physically incapable of doing it. And then he got somebody to drive him and wheel him on the stage and take his oxygen mask off of him and sit there and try to help God's kids get things done that need to be done. And if he ain't one of God's kids, I don't want to be one either. I'm sorry. And then there's my current sponsor, Clancy. I watch Clancy. I watch Clancy do the same things these other two magnificent men in my life did. I watch him, he goes out, and I watch him do things that I didn't get to see the other ones do because I spend a little more time closely with him. Because that's a thing that I do. I watch him night after night after night, after weekend after weekend after weekend, time after time after time, do things that I'm not physically capable of doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if he's not one of God's kids, I don't want to be one either. I just don't. I'm sorry. And when I die, and I'm going to die someday, when I die and I get to wherever I'm going, and if there ain't birds singing and pretty flowers out there and people like Norm Alfie and Chuck Chamberlain and Clancy Emerson, I don't want to go there. I'm sorry. I just don't want to go there. And I'll tell you why. Because when I get to that place and you're not there, I'll be in hell. And the reason I know that is because I was in hell before they came into my life. I know what hell is. I lived in it. I lived in it for 27, 28 years of my life. If it was any hotter than where I was, I hope to God I never get there. And you better pray to God that you don't ever go there either. But I also know the other side of the coin. I know what it's like to live in heaven. Because I've lived in heaven this weekend. I've been around love and excitement and joy and happiness for this thing that gave me life called Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been with the people that I love and the people who love me and the people I respect and the people who respect me. And I had none of that 37 years ago when I walked into your meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and sit down with my scorn and my differences and my attitude. I brought nothing that I had today into Alcoholics Anonymous except this container that I walk around in. And you have filled it up with much. You've given me a purpose for living and a reason for being, and you've given me children that I adore and grandchildren I adore and people that I admire and a God of my very own. And the most gracious gift of all, you've allowed me to love you and be loved in return, I suppose. You know, I hear something in Alcoholics Anonymous that I hear all the time, I really don't understand. I hear people say, I had to learn to love me before I could love you. That ain't the way it is with me. I don't even like me sometimes. But I have never not loved you. I loved you from the first time I saw you to this very moment. I will love you not for what you are, but for what I am when I'm with you. Every living thing I have in my life I owe to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything. Everything I ever hope to have in my life I will owe to this program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And dear friends, you better believe this. It is a long, long walk from a cell in solitary confinement at a maximum security penitentiary to where I stand right now. But for the grace of God, AA, and good folks like you, I could have missed it all. God bless you. Thank you.
Thank you, Johnny, and thank you, everybody, for being here, and we will close with the Serenity Prayer and the Our Father.
This is the end of this cassette. Please advance the tape as far as possible for the next playing.